and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bulkelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 646.
While we cover Core 1-6.
Yeah, there's a little bit of symmetry there.
Barely any.
I know.
I'm just taking whatever segue I can get, man.
You did your best, Chad. Oh, God. Yes.
Speaking of doing your best.
So I read this like Chad already knows. I only read this issue once. Not that I think this would be a major detriment to this recap, because as it is wordy, but yet still not, there's not all that much that, not too much that happens here. So we pick up where we left off, where Aya's like energy twin there is now is blocked out of her body because her body's been taken over by the Manhunters. I do like the art in this issue. I will say that. I think the art is surprisingly potent. In this, we're still a Bayat, home of the Manhunters, and Guy, Razor, Fatality, and the Energy Eye are going to try to find out. They're racing to their ship to see what has happened, even though that was fairly predictable what has happened and why. Why they're puzzled about what happened. That kind of confuses me. But the narration in this issue is interesting because it's Guy. It's Guy being quite reflective and all the Guy's insecurities are coming out, and he's being he's blaming himself for stuff and not take, you know, they were looking to him for leadership, and this is like his big moment to step up, and he kind of crapped the bed and everything. They deal with the Manhunter controlled Aya body, who was able to just like blow through constructs like it's absolutely nothing. You know, Aya is kind of like in a way begging for mercy from herself. But which was easy enough because the Manhunter Aya has bigger fish to fry and is heading back down to the planet in the core. This damaged ragtag group of Lanterns, and they all look pretty beaten up, including Sinestro, which is, you usually don't see Sinestro looking this disheveled, including his hair. So they end up having to go back to Oa. And the core here, the Manhunter core, we have Aya, Manhunter Aya, explaining basically what their goal is. Some of it makes sense. Some of it necessarily doesn't. Taking a shot at the Guardians always makes sense. So, you know, you can't really, the Green Lantern Corps are pretty much have proven over and over again that they can't really do this job. But it's not their fault because they never should have been assigned this job because it's all the Guardians' fault.
Honestly, it's the same Manhunter motive that we had. Pretty much for the, was it in Darkest Night? Was that those two episodes of JLU and the animated series?
You might be right, but it's been so long.
Because they were pissed at the Guardians and they were trying to frame Jon Stewart so that they could get the guard. Because they wanted to come back and take their rightful spot.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those ongoing things you're always going to deal with. The Manhunters Mark won and they failed and they got pushed to the side. Now, did they completely fail on their own? We know Krona obviously has a role in this too. But I mean, did they fail? Were they inherently flawed and they couldn't have been fixed? Or was it just the fact that they got pushed aside because of, you know, the collateral damage and everything that they caused? It's like, well, we're going to scrap this. So we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So there's a revenge factor. And then there's arguably the fact that they're looking at things from a different perspective and realizing that, well, that, you know, it's the fact that these beings who are wielding this power have emotion, which is ultimately their undoing. So for some reason, which I still don't quite understand this logic, that the fact that they have now they have latched on to what will make them, like, this is what they kind of have been missing all along. And what they've been missing is the entities, because the power that comes from the emotional spectrum entities is so massive that if they can control it, then they can pretty much do the job that the Green Lantern Corps can't, because somehow tapping into this raw emotional energy and it being used by beings with no emotion is the way to go. I don't know how well that really flies, but that is their logic. That is their plan. So this issue is Lux Eterna, which is Eternal Light. So Morgan Hampton, Juan Jose Rip, and Will Conrad are the artists. Matt Herms, colorist. Dave Sharp, as usual, the letterer. Fernando Pissarin, Eau Claire Albert, and Arif Prianto, the cover artists. There's only two variants, so it's Jorge Fornes and Ryan Gonzalez. So since there's only two artists, I figured I'd name drop them. Assistant editor, Jillian Grant, Kathleen Wisniewski, and group editor, Paul Kaminsky. Now, back on OA, we're kind of getting an explanation here. They got to do something with Joe. Joe is just driving me nuts. The role they have Joe take in this book, it just drives me nuts. But along, Joe takes the lead in some of this stuff. It gets worse, like when she's about to bitch slap guy and how she becomes an expert at black holes. We'll get to that in a minute. But we find out that, they don't really know why the Manhunters are trying to get the emotional entities. They just know that that's what their goal is. But they're trying to protect the entities because they need, because the entities are going through the universe trying to find suitable hosts until they can mature back to their grown state. They already have Prozolite, which we saw. And John Stewart has brought Parallax back to Oa. And then you have Joe bitch slapping guy, because guy is kind of like almost like he's just paralyzed because he doesn't really know what to do. He's having his self-doubt. It's holding him back. But eventually he's able to focus, and he sees the Butcher, who, of course, looks just like a sheep. So that's a mistake. He sees the Butcher, and it's like, hey, before they can even figure out where he is to try to go rescue him, he gets captured by the Manhunters, who have already captured Predator. Now, we see that Aya has come up with this pseudo failsafe to be able to detect whenever Manhunters are close, and they find out the Manhunters are close to the sun in their solar system, and this relates to Effigy. We knew this was going to pay off at some point, how Effigy stopped fighting John and, was it Ellie, and just kind of like went off towards the sun. Well, he went off towards the sun, and Ophidian is looking for him to be a host, and of course Larfleeze is mortally offended that Ophidian doesn't want him as a host. They're trying to put together a team to go after these Manhunters, but because of the way Aya just kind of like just ripped through all the energy constructs, Guy is making a legitimate, fair assessment that, well, I don't know how much more effective we're going to be to begin with. And then they come up with the idea that, the same group of people that we're never going to host entities again. It's like, now, if we put the entities inside of ourselves, we might be strong enough to stop the Manhunters. So Fatality, of course, is up, as she was, I guess, destined to be, is going to take on Prozolite. Sinestro, of course, because it's Sinestro, steps up to say, well, I'll take Parallax because of his experience with Parallax, which, to be fair, probably would have been the better way to go, objectively speaking, even though Jessica Cruz makes a legitimate reason that I'll quit before I let you have Parallax. We have John Stewart rambling on about, Parallax's power is immense, even though he's in a juvenile state. Why Parallax is in a juvenile state when there's still no evidence Parallax ever died? This seems to be a confusing thing. Let's see if we ever see Timu Parallax again, because I think they've effing written themselves into a corner needlessly. They just never need.
Well, I think honestly, this is still Timu Parallax, because I think that Parallax died. Technically, so the Parallax that we saw in infant form would be a regeneration of the one that died, because technically our other Parallax never did die.
Well, I know that, but remember, this Parallax wasn't a baby. The one that we were dealing with last...
Right, the one that we were dealing with last issue wasn't a baby, but remember, they do mention in this issue how their baby form, because they need to feed off of things. So it could still be
Timu Parallax.
But they shouldn't be grew off of the fear.
But they shouldn't be calling him Parallax.
Yeah.
The point is, again, needless. This is all needless. They should have just effing used Parallax to begin with, or they just never should have had a fear entity. But in their little hodgepodge, get out of jail free, from behind the source wall because they never had a fear entity to begin with. Maybe we're gonna get an explanation for this, but until we do, this is all more confusing than it needs to be because they either screwed up or they don't know what the hell they're doing or they're just whatever. The decision is made that Sora is gonna take on Parallax again, based on the fact that supposedly now that she's overcome her greatest fear that she was forced to face because of Parallax, then now she's gonna be able to control Parallax, which is kind of a joke because we've never seen, other than Sinestro, no one's ever truly controlled Parallax. But yes, this is a weakened Parallax, even with quotes of whether it makes any sense or not. So they kind of do this in a controlled environment as much as they can before they send the two entity hosts to join the other Lanterns. They head to the sun, Oa's son, where Ophidian is tempting Effigy. And it is an interesting little speech about, well, you know, Lorflees is very, very greedy, but he's kind of bastardized his power. And and if Ophidian's just looking for someone who can kind of, who's more than willing to spread the greed around, which Effigy at least acknowledges, well, that's kind of a contradiction by itself, but I don't really care because I'm just looking for an upgrade. So come on in, baby. So he becomes a host real quick. And then all the Manhunters who now, this is annoying, who all look like Aya, by the way, who now all look like Aya. And they begin, there's a fight in Oa's son because they're trying to pull Ophidian out of Effigy. Effigy is kind of in his home element, though, because of the fact of where he is related to the sun and solar powers and everything like that. So he's doing fairly well, but In their conflict, the sun ends up going supernova, and it blows up. And now all of a sudden, it's like everybody's shocked when they're looking at this, which is kind of weird because a lot of people wouldn't even know what it is. It looks like a big eye in space, pretty much. But we're supposed to assume that there's black hole talk in here, which gets annoying because Joe of all people starts explaining what a black hole is because Joe is a walking effing encyclopedia whenever you need it. And they're really not sure how to approach this because we need a plan. But Guy has his bravado up and he goes, this is basically what I'm going to lead by example. And I'm the all site. This is what I need to be. So they start flying. They start flying towards the black hole. They start getting pulled in. And that's pretty much where this issue ends. Next issue, our Lanterns fight off space time as they journey to the center of a black hole. Here's your ball game.
Yeah, I think so. By the way, I think the reason they all look like Aya is explained by Aya. She says the outer shell of my body was built to be.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's just the consequence of visually telling that. You could just say something like, well, the alloy on the Manhunters was changed, I guess you could say, like, in story, but this is a visual way. If they look like Aya, it makes sense that they would have Aya's shell or material abilities. So yeah. I think it's just a visual thing. It looks ridiculous, I agree with you, but also the other art mistake, the fact that the butcher is a sheep or a lamb or, you know, goat or whatever, as opposed to being a cow.
So, a bull.
Yeah. I think they went with like a calf because they were doing the baby form. And then when it grows up, it becomes obviously a big muscle bound hell demon type of bull. But yeah, it's not a goat for sure.
Yeah, it's not. We have no idea what the how screwed up the predator looks because of the fact that he's bagged pretty tight.
Otherwise the art is pretty great.
Yes, like the art is far superior to most of the books we've gotten lately. Jessica looks utterly fantastic. Even Joe, I mean, again, I don't like the way they're writing Joe, but John doesn't look good.
When the girls power up, Yara and Sora, that's their stance and everything. That's real dynamic and cool looking.
Yeah. He seems to draw women better than he draws men.
I like that panel of Sinestro's back is kind of turned towards you, but when he's talking to Jessica about, like, you know, you think we're gonna let you take on Parallax or whatever, he, even though he's turned away from the viewer, he looks great there.
even though the ring's on the wrong hand.
Oh, yeah, because you should be on the left.
Yes, but you were correct. To be fair, I probably wouldn't have even noticed that if you hadn't drawn my attention back to that panel. But, we know mistakes happen, but some of this shit is careless. This is where, again, as we've talked about a lot over the last year, this is where editing is supposed to come into play. Mm-hmm. Editing is supposed to catch this stuff. When in doubt, people need a primer. It's like, oh, Sinestro Corps members wear their rings on their left hand. So if you're not aware of that, now you are. Overall, it's a really good issue. I don't know how much I buy into. Again, it just seems kind of weird that how non-emotional, non-living beings can somehow use energy that comes from or powers emotional beings and is drawn or created from emotional beings, and yet somehow they're able to use that energy. And I guess we have to believe that they're just going to that at the end of the day, it's just like, you know, how energy can't be created or destroyed, mm-hmm. just transformed.
First law of thermodynamics.
Yeah. So I guess at the end of the day, that because the raw energy is so powerful that they're still able to channel it, and that's just a more powerful source. But it just seems weird that since the power is emotional to begin with, that they could possibly ever be stronger than somebody who was who was living, breathing, experiencing that emotion itself.
They may just be extrapolating on the concept they've already been kind of toying with already, the idea of what is Aya. Like, you know, is she capable of her own emotional process? How is that possible? We know it's possible, at least from the cartoon, because she was essentially, they never said Ion, but basically the way they said it was like it was a piece of Ion was used to make the AI, right, in the ship.
I think that was something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they never actually said Ion, but the way they described taking a piece of energy to Green Lantern fans, I think we all was like, they're talking about Ion. So that makes sense. But they also do the same dance in trying to have that conversation about, well, also, what is Ellie? Does Ellie count as a living being, and so on and so forth? How can a living construct be a lantern of any energy other than the construct that they're made of? Like, how is that possible? So they've been dancing with the concept of playing around with inanimate objects or non-feeling emotional beings or machinery having something to do with emotion. It could just be all coming to a head.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. But yeah, generally speaking, I did like this issue. I saw what they're doing with the entities kind of makes me want to bang my head against the wall, even though, again, most of it has to do with the parallax contradiction. It's like, I mean, again, it could be an explanation where, again, this is our parallax, but because they claimed our parallax died, and based on what they just retconned, which makes no sense, that the entities die, they just get reborn, that this is our parallax reborn. But it would be nice if we found out where the F parallax died to begin with, if they're going to give us that crap. Until they reconcile the two fear entities things, I'm going to have it's still going to bother me. But
I also, just in terms of talking about seeing potential tropes coming a mile away, I would not be surprised if at the end of this, Aya doesn't get her body back right away and is stuck as sort of this central intelligence AI projection from the OS system. She said she uploaded herself into the OS system, and then we have to like spend a small story or a short arc of her struggling with her relationship with Razor, not being able to touch him and all of this stuff, and, you know, them having to try and find a suitable body for her, build her one or something. I wouldn't be surprised if we're going there.
It wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me either, in all honesty. But it was fun. It was fun. Again, I mean, Laura Flea still looks crappy most of the time. The close-ups to his face sometimes look good in this issue. Guy is still kind of drawn with a bowl cut again, and that's a problem. Obviously, people just forgot that Guy hasn't been using a bowl cut regularly in a while. So that's probably something we're going to be dealing with for a while, unfortunately. But
this this artist, did you happen to notice how much detail he put into Salak's face?
Yeah, there's absolute, yeah, almost disturbingly so. Because you actually still, like,
you gotta appreciate it.
Yeah, you see like pupils of his eyes, which you never see.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes him look better or worse, but yes, he absolutely put the work in here. Yeah, so most of the characters look, again, Lord Flees looks eh, and John Stewart kind of looks pretty crappy, I'd say, for the most part. For some strange reason, John Stewart does not translate well here. But most of the other, I mean, Fatality looks, she doesn't look like Fatality, really, I don't think, to me, that much in every single panel. But she is drawn well. Jessica, like I said, Jessica looks fantastic. For the most part, Sinestro looks really good. Sora does. Aya does. I mean, in all honesty, when push comes to shove, they should have, even though you can make a case, unless he was desperate enough. That's how, one, that could be, well, I was going to say that could be one way where we find out whether it really was Parallax or not. But then again, that's counting on people who are in charge of handling the Green Lantern books that they know the mythology. I was going to say Parallax, Sinestro taking on Parallax would be the most logical, because we know Sinestro he's the only one that we've ever seen be actually capable of wielding Parallax and not be controlled by Parallax. And a weakened Parallax would be even easier for him to control. But Parallax should not want to go in Sinestro. But that's, again, counting on the people who are in charge of the books understanding and remembering that.
Well, also, wasn't Sinestro's way of controlling Parallax like hurting him? Because I seem to remember they were revealing it was being like very like my captured prisoner, as opposed to, you know, we're working in tandem. Or
yeah, but I don't know if that was all, or even the majority of that was when Parallax was in him, as opposed to how he was like chain. Remember, he was when he was like using Parallax to wasn't he using like Parallax to like fear to power the fear engine or something like that, or partially?
Yeah,
or
maybe I just wouldn't put it past the core to have that information and not want to give him Parallax for more than one reason.
Yeah, I'm sure Joe knows it.
Last thing I want to talk about, unless you have something else, is I'm actually really intrigued by what Ophidian said.
About Laura Flees?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did too. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, because we've talked about this off and on for a little while now. The idea, I think Dan was the one who brought it up a while back. The idea, exploring the idea in these comics, that there is more to love than one way to feel love. There is more to hope, you know, there's more way to hope than just one. And there's more ways to be selfish than just one. And Ophidian basically straight up says it. So like, it makes no sense for, you know, a power of selfishness to want to be spread around, but also that's how the emotional spectrum works, is the more of it there is, the more powerful they are. So it would make sense that the entity of selfishness is struggling with the idea of being able to find somebody who's helping to spread the selfishness around.
Right. And also because Lord Flees has been corrupted in his mind, because of the fact that he's had this power for so long, and that
it's like a billion years at least. Right.
Arguably, it might be hard. It might be, again, from a selfish perspective, it might be harder for Ophidian to influence Lord Flees, because Lord Flees has been bathed and had been such a powerful, has been the only Orange Lantern for so long that he is so friggin' obsessed with being greedy and having everything for himself, that he might be able to resist more than you would think, the corrupting influence of a greed entity. I do think that's cool.
Yeah, I like that they basically outright said it. So that was cool.
Yeah, let's be honest. There's the majority of these entities, let's be kind. More accurate, maybe like 50% of these entities have never really gotten much of a fair shake as far as us ever seeing what they can do. I mean, we've only had a few hosts.
Adara is the clearest one. Adara's because we had that girl that Adara possessed. No,
Hector Hammond was Ophidian, right?
Previously. Yeah. Yeah, but you really didn't get a sense of Ophidian in that, because Hector's mind was so powerful. He was like Parallax Hal, not like Parallax. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, he was definitely influenced by Ophidian, but you didn't really get Ophidian's POV for the most part, I don't think. Did we get to see the Butcher during the Red Lantern series? I forget.
I don't think we did in the Red Lantern series. We've had, I mean, in all honesty, the only entities that we've really had, we've seen a decent amount of hosts, and we've seen a decent amount of what they can do. We've seen Ion, we've seen Parallax,
and Predator. Predator.
And yeah,
Predator.
Because those are pretty much the only ones that we've, and of course, speaking of things that are completely untouched that they threw out there during these stupid Starbreaker supremacies, how about giving us an explanation for, is the white entity in Kyle? Or did it ditch him once they got back into this universe? Those things are kind of effing important. I mean, they really are. I mean, you think Kyle would want to know that once he got told that, basically how his memory was kind of blocked, and then he started getting unfuzzy once he got out. I mean, once he got out, he's being brought up to, brought up to snuff on what actually happened. It's like,
my theory is that the life entity is alive and inside of Kyle and hiding inside of Kyle. And that's why he's having flashes of White Lantern power, but unable to hold it, is because even though the power is in him, it's scared and recovering and hiding or something. And Kyle accessing that much power too long, probably, I don't know, sends a signal or whatever to whatever the entity is scared of coming for it in a weakened state. So that's why he can't hold on to the power very long.
They could do that, but how much of a weakened state should it have been in?
They were all being drained by the source wall.
Right. Well, that was centuries ago. And if he's been in Kyle all this time, if the whole idea is for these reconstituting entities, they need a host to basically regain their full strength. And why would this thing not have regained full strength a long time ago for having Kyle as its host?
Mm.
So, but I don't know. I mean, some of the stuff is intriguing, but I also don't know if they could also dig themselves a lot of holes.
I also wish, my last thought, I also wish that when Sora and Yara got taken over, that their costumes would have changed. And same with Effigy. I understand why they didn't, because of the entities not being at full power, but I still would have liked, I just like the visual of the costume change. I like the creativeness sometimes behind the way people choose to design somebody who is possessed by an entity. Sometimes it's awesome, sometimes it's weird, like Parallax Flash. But I'd still like seeing it when we get a chance to do it. We had three chances with Sora, Yara, and Effigy, and we didn't get any. How cool would, at the very least, an Ophidian effigy standing on the surface of the sun have looked?
Yeah.
I don't know. But we'll never see it.
Well, we could, depending how things play out. We could.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it would be a cool touch if it was subtle, if like as they were gaining power that you would start seeing the subtle changes. John's costume didn't really change much when Parallax was in him either.
Yeah. But
then again, I got to be honest with you, at this stage, when it comes to continuity and who knows what, maybe the artist and or the editorial group or even the writers don't even remember that the costume is supposed to change when they're hosting an entity.
All right. What's next?
So let's see. First, what I saw Mortal Kombat 2. Mortal Kombat 2, which reminded me that when I went back and over the weekend, I watched Mortal Kombat and the 2021 Mortal Kombat. And it reminded me how little of that movie I ever absorbed, because I'm rewatching the movie and it's like, there's probably like about 5 minutes in the movie that I actually remember from when I watched it the first time. I was like, I don't remember any of this. Mortal Kombat 2. I think it's a better movie than the first one they put out in 2021. But is it fantastic? No, that's the fight scenes are cool and there's some cool characters in it. But is Carl Urban appropriately cast? No, I don't think so. I don't know why they went for an over the hill Johnny Cage. But based on the story that they're telling, they give you a reason for it. I just don't necessarily think that it works for me. Something I was going to mention last week, we have more of a game plan now for what the next Planet of the Apes movie is going to be. Because Matt Shakman, who did Fantastic Four First Steps, and I believe did all the Spider-Man, Tom Holland movies up until now, up until the fourth one, that he is going to be directing, and the same writer that wrote Fantastic Four is going to be writing the next Planet of the Apes movie, which will not be a direct follow-up to Kingdom, but that does not necessarily mean that it's, you know, some people, of course, love to read into things or have reading comprehension issues into making it sound like, oh, is it going to be a reboot? It's like, there's nothing that indicates that it's not going to take place in the quote-unquote Caesarverse that we've gotten. That it just means that they're not necessarily picking up on the story that was left, you know, the breadcrumbs that were laid out at the end of the last movie. So, and we don't know when in the timeline it's going to be. It could be something, remember, since Kingdom took place a significant amount of time after War for the Planet of the Apes, that this could be something set between War and Kingdom. So we don't know yet. Something I found interesting, that the next attempt at the Blair Witch Project, a reboot of that, I don't think there's a release date yet, but what's interesting about it is that a huge percentage of people involved in the original Blair Witch Project are going to be involved, at least on, if found no other level, at least on the producing level. The original directors are going to be producers, and Mike and Josh are going to actually be involved. Heather does not appear. And it doesn't surprise me. I think Heather has more issues with, they all have issues with the way they were treated and how financially they were not rewarded based on all the crap ton of money that the Blair Witch Project and that franchise had made early on, that they were not properly compensated or didn't get their piece of the pie. But so I think Heather feels that she was shafted more. So if she doesn't come aboard, it wouldn't surprise me, but it is, because of the way my mind works, I find it more interesting to see if that means that there's some kind of, if there has been any falling out between the three of them, only since two of them have signed on to be producers or executive producers, and Heather at the moment has not. Before I delve into my one major topic of the evening, this is something I meant to ask you this for like the last couple of weeks, because since I finished reading the book, that one thing that was different in Project Hail Mary that we never talked about was by the end of the book, there is no more broken English for Rocky. They're speaking pretty much in complete.
Oh, yeah.
Complete, yeah. Normal, full sentences.
He understands him.
Yes, yeah. because they're both fluent in each other's language. So my question to you is, let's forget about if they're doing a book sequel to this, because obviously this is where the book was left off by Weir. So if he's going to write a sequel to his own book, it is all but guaranteed he's going to pick up with that being the dynamic between Rocky and Grace, unless there's some reason in the movie, I mean, in the book, excuse me, in which that communication pattern has to revert. But let's just say he doesn't write a movie, but he basically comes up with the idea for the script, whether he writes the screenplay himself or he does the story treatment and then they do a screenplay out of it from it. I think I know what you're going to say here, because I know my opinion on this too. Do you think if they do the sequel to Project Hail Mary that they're going to change the way Rocky and Grace talk in the movie, or they're going to continue essentially the broken English pattern because people find it endearing, and that's the nature of the relationship between the two of them that people like?
I think I've watched enough interviews lately with Andy Weir to say that I don't believe he has yet to write a sequel to any of his books. Okay. So we don't know how he writes sequels. So this is all based on nothing but feeling. I feel he wants to write a sequel to his book to appease that story. I don't think he would take hints or changes based on the reception of the adaptation.
So which kind of does not entirely answer my question, but it does lead to a possible answer. So yeah. You think he would just... So you would think if he was going to write the book, he would obviously pick up on the communication pattern that they had at the end of the book. But even though he would probably assume they would change it for the movie.
Right. I believe he would, because he thus far, when he talks about writing a sequel, he's talking about writing a sequel specifically in terms of the next book. He has not talked about solely just coming out with a screenplay or, you know, I'm not going to do another book, but I'll help with the screenplay or any of that. He has given no indication that's anything he would ever want to even consider. So I don't think he would keep the eventual adaptation in mind. He would just pick up where he left off in the book.
Right. But again, laser-like focus here. When they make if they make a sequel, regardless whether it came from a source book or whether they just make a sequel based on, do you think they're going to change the communication pattern, or you think they're going to keep it because that's what people are used to and that's what people like?
They'll probably find a way to keep it. Maybe if like the Eridians go to Earth or something like that.
I agree. I think they'll keep it because I think that's what people. I think that people like the way they communicate, or the way Rocky communicates, because he's the only one who really technically is speaking in broken. In a broken language. All right, so one last topic for the day, and this is not disclaimer. Two disclaimers. Number one, this is not going to be a referendum on the actual first domino that fell that caused this whole situation, because that's water under the bridge now. As far as it, whether you thought it was right or wrong, it no longer matters. And I'm including the statement that was made. That's really what I'm referring to, and the actions that followed, because it's happened. So now it's over with, and this is just about the fallout of it. And I do like Melissa Barrera, so that's where we're segueing into next. But I'm not blind as far as being able to read the room and understand when things come across poorly and when you're kind of digging a hole needlessly over and over, because Melissa Barrera did an interview with Variety, and the whole thing wasn't about Scream, but it did transition to Scream, which, again, objectively speaking, she should realize almost any interview can segue into Scream, because it's something that's going to be one of those defining aspects of her career as long as Scream is a thing. If Scream stops being a thing, then the odds are increased dramatically that over time people will stop asking her about it. But since Scream is a thing, movie and Scream 7 just came out, as much as it sucked, and Scream 8, rumors are, might be going to production as early as about the end of the year, that she's going to be asked questions. So because, this interview basically serves as an early nominee for the 2026, and probably the favorite, for the 2026 Rachel Zegler Silver Foot in the Mouth Award, along with kind of channeling her own, I guess, bizarro Michael Corleone, just when I was out, I pull myself back in. That she gets asked some questions. This whole part of the interview that segues into Scream is it's like a publicist nightmare, because there's no way on God's green earth you pretty much could have handled these questions any worse than Melissa Barrera. There's so many ways you can answer questions like this. You could avoid the questions altogether. You could take the high road with all this stuff and just say, well, I really enjoyed my time in the franchise, but that time has passed. You could choose it to go after the studio or the producer, the studio and the producers, studio heads, basically, but still do it in a diplomatic way. Instead, that's not how this interview goes at all. So right off the bat, she kind of starts digging a hole, as in a rabbit hole, because she goes down the conspiracy theory hole about how the Scream 7 box office wasn't legit. So Melissa Barrera, no evidence, of course, but she believes that the box office for Scream 7 was cooked. They cooked the books because they had a vested interest to. Now, if you want to go down that road, is it impossible for that to happen? Probably not. But you have to. It's not just the studio cooking the books. The whole industry would kind of have to be complicit in it. Because this would be bad news if it blew up in your face that you were, cooking the book. And I don't mean the way Disney cooks the books, that, oh, this movie only cost $200 million to make, and then because it was filmed in England, and England for tax purposes has to release the actual budget, and you find out the movie cost $325 million. That's a game when it comes to whether a movie is profitable. That's not referring to how much money it pulls in at the box office. It would be a dangerous road to go down. Plus, you think about it, the industry would have to be complicit, and probably at least 70% of the people in the industry they probably believe everything Melissa Barrera said to start with, that got this whole thing down, the whole first domino to fall that got her fired off of Scream 7. So I don't think that's very realistic, but if you're going to go down that road and think the box office for Scream 7 could be cooked, the books could be cooked there, that I think you almost have to accept that the box office for Scream 6 would have been cooked too. Because the studio had just as much, arguably more, of a reason to want Scream 6 to do better than Scream 5 beyond, you know, the fact that everybody wants the next chapter to do better financially. But they had a vested interest in hoping that movie was going to do better because they had another controversy for Scream 6, not a woke SJW controversy, but a arguably a more important one with the core of the fan base. And that was when not only did Neve Campbell not come back for Scream 6, she pretty much went public about the reason why and saying, well, the studio was being too cheap. They lowballed me. They didn't give me the money I deserved. So they had just as much, if not more, of a reason to want to make sure Scream 6 succeeded more than 5 to say, look, see, our decision was okay. We didn't make a mistake. Or it didn't hurt us at the box office as much as they would have had it for 7, in my opinion. But she seems to believe, you know, again, she wants, it fits her narrative, and that's the reason why I think she wants to believe it. The second part of this is, I mean, the question was ridiculously leading, and I think it was borderline, disgusting might be too strong a word, but I think it was inappropriate going down the road that they did. But the interviewer phrased this, and it's clearly Melissa Barrera was baited, but she took it hook, line, and sinker. And she was asked whether, from her perspective, whether the returning actors who she worked with in Scream 5 and 6, or 5 or 6, coming back, the ones that decided to come back for Scream 7, did she consider them, quote-unquote, scabby, as in crossing a picket line, scab? And, like I said, 1,000 different ways to answer questions. She could have expressed an opinion but distanced herself from the framing device. But no, she said, yeah, pretty much so. And they made their decision, and they have to live with that. Now, I'm going to give Melissa Barrera, whether she deserves it or not, the benefit of the doubt that she really wasn't talking about Neve Campbell and Courtney Cox, because if she was, including them, then you would probably need about 5 or 6 days just to deflate your head to close to normal size because of your ego and your narcissism. If you really think that the two stars of the original franchise that are left, as in characters that are still alive, should not do another Scream movie just because you got fired because of something that you said that there were repercussions from, and that everybody should follow suit. It's a borderline narcissistic view for anybody, any of her co-stars, but if she was really applying it especially to those two, it would make no sense. And even with Neve Campbell, I'm pretty sure Melissa Barrera did publicly support Neve Campbell when she came out publicly and stated what her issues were when it came to Scream 6, and said she was brave for you know, basically sticking to her guns and coming and going public. It's not like Melissa Barrera said to the studio, you're not treating Neve Campbell properly. You know, she is Scream. There's no Scream without Neve Campbell. So if you don't pay her what she's asking to bring her back for this movie, I'm not going to do Scream 6. Doesn't look like she did that. There's no evidence that she did. So it still kind of would be hypocritical to expect other people to just follow that lead and just not come back. Now, I think the two people she must be referring to are Mason Gooding and Jasmine Savoy Brown, Chad and Mindy Meeks, the Randy's niece and nephew in the series, because they were the only two of the quote-unquote core four from 5 and 6 that came back for Scream 7. She also made some comment later on in this interview about people that supported her privately but not publicly. She basically didn't – that meant nothing to her. She had no use for that. Now, again, giving her the benefit of the doubt, I'm going to assume she's not talking about every single person in her personal life that either texted her or called her and gave her some emotional support, that they didn't publicly tweet or send an Instagram post that was irrelevant to her. I don't think she meant it that way. Again, benefit of the doubt. I'm assuming she's just talking about professionally people who she's worked with. So I think she's talking about those two. But even so, it's still kind of narcissistic, egotistical, because you kind of led these two people to a cliff without them even realizing they were being taken to a cliff. And then because you ended up going off the cliff, you're expecting them to go with you. I don't know. I think that's kind of odd just by itself. And the last thing, unless you want to jump in now,
Well, okay. Yeah, I can see why that question would be considered leading. It's just once you put a term like scabs in the frame, it kind of nudges the answer in a specific direction already, even if the person might have had chosen different wording otherwise. But I kind of came away thinking that the article was more about Hollywood social politics than movies. Like, you know, who's safe to support or who isn't, or who stays quiet or who waits for permission. And
all of that shit. But yeah, calling the returning cast scabs kind of felt like the point where the interview shifted from here's my experience to taking shots at people. I think it was interesting that the most human parts of the interview are kind of the moments where she's talking about losing her identity as the actress and not the moments where she's trying to make broader industry statements. Because I thought like the Broadway sections felt like the strongest parts.
Oh, yeah. Because the main reason I'm sure she did the interview.
Yeah, it's just stopped sounding like industry grievance and started sounding like an actual person talking about something they love. And we all know I'm not invested in Scream itself, but this interview definitely feels less like closure and more like she's still actively litigating what happened in the court of public opinion.
And she also does speak highly of the fans and the experience of being in the movie. So the final thing to wrap up, which to me it's the most interesting thing in the interview, and it's the one and the one thing of the three of these three, if you divide them into three, basically the box office, the scab part, and this, what I'm about to talk about, this is the one part where I kind of suspect she's right, at least partially, but because, in my opinion, she's such an unreliable narrator up to this point, but there's other two topics, it makes me wonder because this is what I believed all along, but it makes me start doubting myself because of this. Because the interviewer gets asked about Jenna Ortega not coming back for Scream 7 either. And there's a narrative out there, because when Jenna Ortega didn't come back for Scream 7, there were basically, at different times, there were three different explanations given, none of which I think Jenna Ortega has really ever discussed in public, I don't think. If not, very little. I don't think she's ever confirmed one way or the other. But first, it was the traditional conflict, scheduling conflict, that there was another project that she had to make. It was going to get in the way of the time Scream 7 was going to shoot, so she didn't do it. Shortly after that, I think this, and this could have been hijacked by the people who wanted to believe this for their own personal and political reasons, that was said publicly, but the real reason she didn't do it was to show support for Melissa Barrera, solidarity. And then after that, another version kind of circulated, kind of going along the Neve Campbell route, where it was money, that basically Paramount wasn't giving her enough money, and which I don't remember that ever being specifically described, if this was an ongoing issue, like even before Melissa Barrera got canned, whether there was still an ongoing cash issue between Ortega in the studio, which there could have been, because while Ortega is not playing the main character, she's clearly the biggest star of the four, of the core four actors that were in Scream 5 and 6. Again, not talking about when Courtney and Neve Campbell came back in 5. But of the new characters introduced, there's no doubt that Jenna Ortega is the biggest actual star of the group, even though she's not playing the main character. So it was never specifically said this was either an ongoing issue or this became an issue once Barrera was gone, and now Jenna Ortega was clearly in a catbird seat because of the fact that she was going to be the star if she was going to come back. So maybe she was asking for a lot of money, and they said no. But either way, the interviewer brings up the concept or the narrative that Jenna Ortega left to be in solidarity with Melissa Barrera, and Melissa Barrera really shoots that down pretty quickly, that she makes it crystal clear she ain't believing that. That as far as she's concerned, that's not what happened, and that's not the real reason Jenna Ortega didn't do the movie. Could that be her way of saying that might be partially the reason? Because it could be part of the reason. But my personal belief is I never really believed she quit 100% in solidarity for Melissa. But it could be a combination of all these. But I found it fascinating, again, though it goes with the tone of this part of the interview, that she kind of throws everybody under the bus. So in her own way, she's throwing Jenna Ortega under the bus, because Jenna Ortega has kind of gotten a lot of street cred, certainly from a certain side of the aisle, because she was willing not to come back to support Melissa Barrera when Barrera is making it clear, well, she didn't come back, but that ain't the reason. But I found it fascinating because, again, Melissa Barrera is going to have to make peace with this, because she's going to be asked this a lot. So she's either got to take the high road, she's either got to not talk about it anymore, or she needs to just make some kind of peace no matter how she has to do this, because she really came across, I think, poorly in this part of the interview. And the timing is poor, because, again, everything had kind of come and gone, and her career is kind of picking back up again. And, you know, she didn't even really need to go down the Scream top road. yeah, she was led there, but again, but that's it. That's it. I just found it particularly, I found it particularly interesting, and it's just kind of head scratching. It's like, it's not like she couldn't have known screen questions were probably coming at some point, and then certainly in some of these interviews, or she, like I said, she should know Scream is always around the corner at any point. So you better at least figure out how you're going to approach it, even if it's just saying, well, I pretty much said everything. I think I've said everything I have to say about that topic. And it's like, it was part of my life. It's over with. And it's like, I enjoyed the movies when I made them, and I have no ill will, even if she clearly does, but say it. I have no real, I mean, I really have no hard feelings toward anybody at this point. It just, things didn't work out, and that's it. But either way, she's got to do something, because every time she gets asked about Scream, she can't go down this road and kind of almost borderline acting like a petulant child.
Yeah, it's like somebody with no media training or something like that.
I'm sure her publicist must have been banging their head against the wall when they saw this interview. I find it very, yeah. I mean, it's like, oh my God, it's like, how could, especially like we both said, especially the scab question. She could have talked, she could have, if she wanted, obviously she has
it. It's not even hid well. It's the journalistic definition of a leading question.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then she clearly it was perfect for, it was a perfect setup, because she has issues there. Maybe the reporter already knew that she had issues, so it was going to take very little amount of breadcrumbs to have her just go straight for it. But still, she could have talked about, she could have addressed her feelings, or maybe made it clear more. She could have attempted to make it seem like she had some mixed feelings about this, because I really liked the people I worked with, but I don't necessarily feel like I was supported as much as I could have been. But she could have still, no matter how she wanted to go into that, she could have absolutely distanced herself from the scab framing and saying that's a bit harsh, or I don't really view it that way at all. But she didn't. She just took the bait, and it just made it worse.
Yeah, that's definitely why we assume she did not get media training on this, or just didn't listen to her publicist. Because one of the first things, I've never even been in this industry, but I'm damn sure one of the first things that media training goes over is to not take the bait of a leading question. Yeah.
And who knows, I don't think she would have reacted that way as far as answering the question so quote unquote openly, even if you think she's like out in left field, the way she's answering the questions. I don't think this would be the case because of how she just dove in, unless the reporter had been tipped off that just bring up Scream and she's going to go off. And it's like tailor-made for you. You just throw out a breadcrumb here and just step back and let her do it. But unless the reporter was tipped off, you would think, maybe I was going to say, maybe again, trying to give her the benefit of the doubt, maybe Scream was already made clear that she didn't want to talk about Scream, or the interviewer had said, oh, well, this is just going to be about Broadway, or this is just going to be about, you know, where your career is now. And then she didn't expect a Scream question. But like I said, I would, and who knows, maybe that was partially true. But either way, obviously there's a lot bubbling up under the surface that all I needed was a little, like a pinprick to let it come to boil over, to pop out and boil over into this, onto the surface. And man, it definitely overflowed.
Yeah. All right. Is that it?
I believe that is it.
All right. Well, if people want to reach out to us, what do they do?
LanternCast.com. The email is LanternCast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, Facebook, #GeoCast to track us down. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean. Oh, yes. And one day we should talk about Spotify soon. Let people know what's going on. Unless you want me even to do it. Unless we want to do it real quick now.
We might as well take a few seconds. We're not on a countdown yet.
No. We're having some issues with Spotify as far as, for some strange reason other than probably some Manhunter-like algorithm is taking over, that's going back to comb podcasts over and over again, or maybe more rigidly with new standards. But we've had a bunch of episodes flagged over – not a bunch. We've had a few episodes flagged over the last couple of weeks in which episode 241, I believe, which we still haven't figured out what the issue is. Oh, it's something specific to, what was it, James Brown?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there must be a clip of a song in there at some point, and that's like a two-hour episode, because that's probably, we're reviewing like four or five books a month in one episode. So eventually we're gonna go through this and figure out what the issue is and cut out whatever needs to be cut out. But the first time we had an episode of Pre-Birth flag because of the Kansas song in the beginning, so that was episode 3, I believe. So I put a new opening in, different song, which was in the running to begin with for being one of the intro or outro songs. Whether it's going to solve the problem or not, we don't know. It's a lot shorter, that's for sure. I can tell you it's like about 25 seconds versus the we had about
40 seconds. It might flag it just because it's a copyrighted song, regardless of how
long. Yeah, it might. It might.
Yeah.
But it might not, but it might be, again, you can't Carry On My Wayward Son is a pretty big song. So that might be more likely to be caught. But we're experimenting. So I replaced replaced the theme song in Pre-Birth 3 with a different song, 26 seconds versus like the 46 or 47, 48 or whatever Carry On was. So we're going to see how that flies. If for some reason it doesn't seem to get flagged, again, then which will still suck, but then I will go back through and all the episodes of Pre-Birth, I will swap out the song for the new song, and then have to change the update all the information to make it match, because the episode length won't be the same anymore. But just giving people the heads up that in case something gets pulled off, if you listen on Spotify, we are going to address it as much as we can, and clearly you can still go to our website and listen to the episodes in the meantime, no matter what. But I figured since I saw Spotify, I probably should wanted to mention it.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say,
go ahead.
So what's happening, guys, if you haven't, because I've been on Twitter a lot especially this month, hyping up Green Lantern Day, which as we recorded, this hasn't happened yet, which is why I don't have an update for you guys on how it went. But I've been seeing anyways, lots and lots and lots of creators, specifically YouTubers, talking about how their channels have been getting demonetized out of nowhere. And then all of their reviewing stuff that they're trying to like get their stuff reviewed to, it's being flagged by bots. YouTube has AI roaming their system, flagging things for inauthentic content, and then auto suspending the monetization of these people's YouTube channels without doing a manual direct person review of the account before they get rid of the monetization. The reason I bring this up is because Spotify also has things, AI scrolling their system to listen for things to flag. But as far as I'm aware, the thing that Spotify is doing is usually put there by the studios to roam various catalogs of public content for their copyrighted works, because you can obviously like just have the AI recognize the sound wave patterns of their specific individually licensed songs and recognize it in other content and immediately cause it to send a copyright flag. So because we used to use copywritten type songs in our older episodes, as opposed to stuff people made for us or stuff that's non DMCA free or something like that, a lot of old stuff is just going to start getting flagged out of nowhere. That's my anticipation at the very least.
Yeah. And it does unfortunately open the door for a lot of, again, it depends how rigid they're going to be, because, obviously the rules used to be that you could sample something to a certain extent, often, not necessarily like it was slam dunk, you could get away with it. But if you took like 10 seconds of something and put it in, that you were going to, the odds are you were going to be safe, especially if it was in the beginning of an episode. So it's possible other things that we've thrown in over the years could get flagged, which will suck. But the good news, at least we know our intro and our outro seem to be safe, we think. At least our intro is safe. We know that.
Yeah, the only copyrighted work you could say that we even had for an intro at one point would be the stuff that I took from the graphic audio adaptation of Heroes Quest. And that's so very niche specific. And I don't think graphic audio even licenses anything to DC anymore, so I don't know why that would count. So
yeah, I'm still fascinated about that. That's why I'm curious to find out where that James Brown reference is in episode 241, because it's obviously not the beginning. I mean, unless it's, I doubt it's at the end. So wherever you threw that one in, that's what I'm going to be fascinated about, and to see how long it is that they would flag that. But again, it could be any
Marvin Gaye.
Oh, that's right, Marvin Gaye.
Yeah.
I knew it was some classic.
They specifically said What's Going On, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which would be even worse if it's like a 5-second clip. That would be even more annoying. But again, it could be where certain songs and certain artists are going to be more prominent and be flagged more often than others. But we're going to find out, and obviously if this would affect us more going forward. But it still would be a pain. It's still going to be a pain in the ass, because it's not just a matter of swapping out a song and putting in a new song. Because obviously we could always put in, we could just put in the traditional Lantern Cast opening, yeah, like the modified one I did for Jokey with Jim and I could always throw that in for pre-birth.
Well, the other reason we mentioned this, guys, I think is unintended, but it helps. It's very possible that maybe we missed an email or something like that. So if you are listening to older episodes of the Lantern Cast on Spotify specifically, or I guess even other platforms, and you get to one episode and it seems like it just skips episodes, or it skips a group of episodes, like what happened to episode whatever, email us, let us know, just so we can double check.
Yeah, because again, this will be time consuming, but it's something that we can start working on. I mean, just like it was time consuming when we had to, I'm trying to remember what it was. I think when a lot of the links, I think, were lost on the website. I think that's what it was.
Oh, yeah.
Once it's got transferred over to, from Jim, I think, to me, something like, so a lot of the playable links on our actual website for the episodes were shot. So I had to go through, and that's when we found out there were a couple of episodes that were missing, that were not uploaded properly, or the code. I think it was some of the episode names, I think, were incorrect in the coding, and that's why it wasn't playing. So there was a bunch of stuff, but again, it would take some time to do. I mean, it would suck with pre-birth, because basically every episode of pre-birth would have to be touched, and then it's a matter of swapping it out, and it would almost be better off doing it in bunches. It's like fixing like three or four episodes at once, because then I could just fix the XML file. Fix the XML file in all the places that has to be fixed for all those episodes, but do it at one time, one day, and then upload it, as opposed to doing it five or six different times. Every time I update one episode, like do like 1 through 7 or something in one day and fix it. So then at least, you know, 1 through 7 is all correct, and you uploaded it all at one time.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check my Action Comics Weekly stuff, because I use David Bowie's Heroes. That's got to be flagged probably.
We'll figure that out. So yeah, so Apple Podcasts, Spotify, you bastards, Podbean, and anywhere else you listen to us on, please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you like to leave us a text or a voicemail, or I think like Paul, who wanted our Discord information, which I took care of tonight. So if you haven't checked your email by the time this comes out, Paul, you should have it. That's 708 Lantern, and let us know what you think.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.